Okay, welcome to His Holy Church X-Spot, and we're going to look at economics again. We had a couple of programs already about economics, and of course, in the Kingdom of God, the economic system is capitalism, and of course, as we explained, that capitalism by itself is insufficient. It's not a governmental system. It's simply a system where individuals have a right to what they produce, which of course is a part of the original scheme of God, plan of God, where God endowed man with certain rights. He has the right to, listed off at least by Thomas Jefferson, of the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. I always had a quandary about the pursuit of happiness, because that is a relative term. What makes you happy? Well, really, what it probably should say is that you have a right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of righteousness. And because righteousness is the only thing that will give you happiness. So basically, the Kingdom of God is pro-capitalism. But capitalism is insufficient by itself because it is simply an economic system. So people create other systems like socialism and communism. They are political systems where you don't really own anything. The collective owns it. It is what the Bible calls one purse. Let's all have one purse. And that means that you all own everything collectively. And we give you the example also in Proverbs where it says, let us build us a city, and the city will be our cauldron. We'll all be in the cauldron. All that we own will be in the cauldron, and we will all eat of the stuff that's in the cauldron. Of course, both systems of socialism and communism and other monetary systems that are similar to those, the one purse, the cauldron is our city concept where we all own everything as a collective, they all have to have somebody who decides if you're eating too much or not getting enough. So they have to have some sort of exercising power. And of course, that's where kings come in. It's also where presidents come in. It's also where prime ministers come in. It's also where legislatures come in, because they determine what you get and what you don't get. And of course, in order to do that, they also have to create police forces. And a police force is men who exercise force according to the policies of the king, the president, the prime minister, or the legislature. In the Kingdom of God, you don't have any of those things. In the Kingdom of God, there's only really one basic institution that God created at the beginning, and that was the family. A man and his wife, usually one wife, that's the recommended amount, and at least according to Christ, from the beginning, it was one man, one woman. That's what we see played out in the description. One man and one woman. Some people say, oh, well, there was another woman, Lilith, and stuff. That's not in the Bible. So if we're going to go off the Bible at all, and you don't have to if you don't want to, but I use it because I think it's a pretty good story of how it all works. And so we narrate the story by reading the Bible. And when we narrate the story, that gives us some idea about creation. Of course, creation is still all around us, so we can look at nature and the nature of people and human nature, etc., and get a better idea of what's really going on. But the Bible is a narrative, and if we compare that narrative to what we see in nature, or see in other people and the nature of other people around about us, sometimes that helps us make more sense out of the narrative that we're reading in the Bible. Of course, we've got problems with the narrative because you might be reading it in Persian, or you might be reading it in Arabic, and you might be reading it in English or Swahili or whatever your language is, and then you're reading the opinions of the translators. So ultimately, though, the Bible itself says it's not given to private interpretation, whether in this language or that language, but ultimately it keeps pointing to the Kadesh, to the Holy Spirit, to divine sparks, you know, the Yod, to revelation, to things we call prophecy. And we just did a study in Leviticus 8, which I had completely edited and now have to re-edit because somehow we lost the original edit. And we had some computer problems. But anyway, I've already started it. But the reality is in Leviticus 8, they mention breastplates and breasts and wave offerings, and all these things have different meaning. And you'll have to go start studying Leviticus. I'd recommend you go back to Leviticus 1 at preparingyou.com. You can also get us at podcasts at all sorts of different podcast outfits, Spotify, etc., where you look for Keys to the Kingdom with Brother Gregory and you can find us. But I recommend that people listen to that because we start revealing. Of course, that's why we also have preparingyou.com, where we have side notes and footnotes and connection to other articles so that you can do your own research. And in doing your own research, there's at least three things that we recommend: reading and listening to our audios and reading our pages, praying about it, asking God, asking the Holy Spirit that might be speaking to you in your heart. Set aside your emotions and your preconceived notions, because that's going to make noise in your head, and you're not going to be still and know, which they also mention in the Bible over and over again. They also talk about wait and pray and watch and pray. Well, this is part of that process that Abraham was learning, that Jacob was learning, that Moses was learning, where you watch and pray, you be still and know, like other prophets, Elijah, etc., and you receive that divine spark, that inspiration. That's going to be a very personal thing. But when you go back and look at the narrative, go back and look at the text, and go back and look at your neighbor and history and how people interact over the years, there should be an overlapping confirmation in all these different things. But it's not an intellectual endeavor as much as it is a spiritual endeavor. So I'm going to be using intellectual terms to talk about these spiritual endeavors and what is really going on. So socialism, communism, democratic socialism, all the different names that you have, kingdoms where there's a ruler over you, where, you know, I mean, for years, this whole story of Robin Hood had been a lord at one time. He was a free man, and he had a freehold title in himself, etc. And he was defrocked of his title eventually, and the legend goes on. But ultimately, he was accused of poaching deer, because all the deer belonged to the king. If you go back and study common law, deer don't belong to the king. Before there was a king, the deer just belonged to nature. And you could obtain ownership of the deer by hunting it and capturing it or shooting it and killing it. But then when the kings came along, which weren't around for a long time in Great Britain, you could hunt the deer. But eventually the king said you couldn't hunt the deer. Well, common law still said the king didn't own it till he captured it. So why does the king own it and he hasn't captured it? Because he owned his subjects. When William the Conqueror came, he brought with him a system other than the common law. It was a system of kings ruling over the people, and they claimed a divine right of kings. And he brought with it his own economy. People were still using gold and silver. There were other things that they were trying to use for money. But basically, he was creating a political system that exercised authority where the people are subject. But when William the Conqueror first came, there were lots of Englishmen who were not subject to the crown of William the Conqueror. And they still used the common law. And for 200 years, 300 years, you would see court cases. If you go back and study in history, where this court case was decided at common law, and this court case was decided in the king's court. And they would actually make contracts saying which court they would use. Both courts operated side by side. The laws that came down from William the Conqueror and the other kings that followed him for a couple hundred years, they didn't even write their laws in English. They wrote their laws in French. I was just listening to a lady from Iran. She's a Persian. And she was narrating the history of Iran. That for, you know, a large portion of Iran is Persian. They have their own language. They had their own flag. They had their own government. And they had this for years and years and years. And along comes a new guy put in place by other powers, other countries, funded by other countries, had some people in Persia that wanted, but not a majority, a great minority. And he came in and he had to actually bring people from other countries to support his administration. This is the Ayatollah. And he made laws that you had to learn Arabic. And he changed their flag, started writing on it in Arabic. Well, a lot of the Persians didn't speak Arabic. But they weren't in a minority, but they had no way of uprising. And this is one of the things that, why were they so susceptible to a religious, you can call them a fanatic, you can call them a devout Muslim cleric who came in and became the supreme leader of the entire country of Iran, even though the vast majority of the people didn't really want him to take over. And even if there was only a minority, say 40%, that didn't want him to take over, how does their rights fall under his authority? And of course, that's why I mentioned William the Conqueror. William the Conqueror came. The only ones that had to bow down to William the Conqueror, bend the knee, take an oath of fealty to William the Conqueror, is all those people of Great Britain who sided with Harold to fight William the Conqueror, because he wasn't coming to conquer England. He was coming to conquer Harold, because Harold had made a promise and he didn't keep it. So he came to enforce that promise. When he defeated Harold, everybody that fought with Harold had to take an oath of fealty. A large percentage of Great Britain, I don't know if it's 20% or 30% or 40%, did not support Harold and therefore did not have to take an oath of fealty. But if you watch the history closely, you'll see over the next 100, 200, 300 years, one guy after another would end up taking that oath of fealty. And there was lots of things they tried to do to prevent them from having to take that oath of fealty and losing their right to their own land, land that had been in their family for hundreds of years. But they could just see the handwriting on the wall that William the Conqueror and subsequent kings that followed his reign we're constantly being collecting more and more people under their with an oath of fealty under their authority, and Englishmen were going from being freemen to being subjects to this new king. That happened rapidly in Iran, and it's happened in many other countries over the last 2,000 years, or the last 1,300 years especially, where somebody came into their country, conquered the people who were in charge of their government, and steadily made more and more people take an oath of fealty and subject themselves, or be killed by the sword, or be heavily taxed. And of course, I'm speaking mostly of the Arab countries that were doing this. They're not the only ones. Britain did the same thing when it was creating its empire. It would come into a harbor and level the city with its cannons from its ships, and it could send in troops and take over. This was a period of time of imperialism, where a stronger nation would take over a weaker nation. Well, we actually, that although most of that happened in the 1600s and 1700s, it definitely happened in Iran. They didn't use ships. They used banks to finance their taking over of Iran. But why were the Persians so weak to allow this to happen? And of course, if we understood the Bible, we would know why the Persians were so weak and allowed this to happen. And the Persians and the population of Iran had steadily, from 1920, 1930, 1940, created a false economy, which is what this particular broadcast is supposed to be about. And we will cover false economies. We actually did part of the elements of a false economy when we studied capitalism. And we also, you know, we referred to soul economics. And actually, we're going to bring both of those together to play in false economics. But there's a lot of levels of this false economics. Obviously, capitalism requires that you actually have capital. That means present value. You have an actual title to the land itself. This is what Robin Hood lost, is the actual title to the land. This is what the English lost. They actually lost the title to their land. And if you knew history and the details of history, you would know that William the Conqueror started a book. You know, he knew that he didn't conquer all of England. He knew who was in the army with Harold. And he knew who had to take oath of fealty, and he made a record of it. Some of my relatives were with William the Conqueror. Some of my relatives were also already in England. And some of my relatives were also in Ireland, because we, you know, if you go back far enough, you'll go back to the time where some of our relatives were living in Ireland when William the Conqueror came ashore with a Norman named Longbow. And I believe it was Longbow. That's what I recollect. But he was one of our relatives. But then he married into other members of the English families. And then eventually some of our other descendants, de Bullion, I am descendant of de Bullions, and so they came over too. I don't remember, they actually went back and forth, so I don't know when the last time they came over, but eventually, you know, they changed their name when they would come over, but eventually they married into other English families, and eventually they fell out of favor and they moved to Ireland, and they married Irish lasses in Ireland, and they changed their name again. And eventually they came to America. We've married Norwegians and Germans and everything. But our family goes all the way back to that time. But why? during this history, and my father went back and studied a lot of this stuff when he retired, and he would always equate, this is the way he taught us history to some degree, is he would say, well, you had a grandfather here, and this was going on when he, you know, in the history at the time. And so we'd relate to this. We all have this history. We just don't all remember it. We don't all study history. But back to William the Conqueror. He created a book. And I don't know what he called it in French, but the English gave it a name. They called it the Doomsday Book. And everybody who had to take an oath of fealty to the king, their names were written in the Doomsday Book. And by essence, that was entering into the cauldron of the king. He had spelled out what some of your rights were. Eventually, they would have the Magna Carta that would roll back some of the power because the king was taking too much power, and it would send some of it back to the noblemen, etc., and freemen, and they had all these terms. But hundreds of years are passing. And most Americans, they don't know the history of the century they live in. There's a lot of Americans who don't even know the history of America from 2000 on, much less from 1900 on, and certainly not from 1776 on or 1600, 1619. Some of my earliest relatives came to America in the early 1600s and married other gals here already. So the reality is all this stuff is going on, and there is a pattern taking place in history. Either you're moving towards liberty under God or you're moving away, and that direction may change from generation to generation. And one of the tools of moving you to a state of being subject in a is a false economy, to create a false economy where you don't actually, when you buy your land, you don't actually own your land. You own some sort of entitlement to your land, but it's under the authority of the king or the president or whoever the king and the president are under the authority of. You don't actually own it. And that's, of course, what was happening in England when they created the Doomsday Book. And in the Doomsday Book, if you were, your land and your name was mentioned in the Doomsday Book, the king had authority over, some authority over you as a subject of the king. Now, that authority may grow over a period of time by your actions and the king's actions, but it once you're in the Doomsday Book, your land is in that. And why did they call it the Doomsday Book? Because when all the land of England was registered in the Doomsday Book, then it would be doomsday. It would be ready for doomsday. Second coming, Armageddon, or whatever you want to call it, that's going to be coming. But part of that process of going from freemen under God to subjects registered in the Doomsday Book, where not only your land is in the Doomsday Book, but everything you own is in the Doomsday Book, including you, slaves and souls of men, might be in the Doomsday Book. And so this is a process, and like I said, part of that process is to create a false economy. But there's lots of different kinds of false economies. Of course, in capitalism, like I said, you have to have actual capital. So therefore, the money you use to buy things with has to have present value, because capital is something of actual value. You know, if I promise to pay you monopoly money, money, monopoly money, doesn't have any present value. It's just monopoly money. If I promise to pay you modern Federal Reserve notes, they have no value because they're not redeemable. And when I say they don't have any present value, I'm actually quoting the Federal Reserve website on the money they issue. It has no present value. It's false money. It's not real money. It has no real value. It has bookkeeping value, but it has no present value. And they say that. I'm not making it up. They say it. I read it right off Federal Reserve website. The notes they produce have no present value. So, of course, and in our book, Covenants of the Gods, in the article at Preparing You, legal title, if you look up legal title, we go through it step by step, at least enough of it, so that you can see you cannot buy. If somebody actually owned land, you found somebody who actually owned the land, had a freehold title, what the English called a freehold title in land. At one time, they used to call it a fee simple title, but I don't like that term because the meaning of that term evolved over time. But at one time, fee simple title meant you had the basic simple title to the land, and you actually owned it as an owner of the land. But a legal title doesn't include that. And if you found somebody who had the actual lawful title of the land, sometimes in America we see the phrase allodial title. And I know of allodial titles still to this day, actually in our county. There's an actually registered allodial title in land. It can't be taxed. It's based on being an allodial title, not that it's church property or something, or cemeteries are not taxed, but it's an actual allodial title. But if you were to buy that land and you bought it with a Federal Reserve note or any kind of a note, a check, etc., it is not considered in law that you actually bought that. You cannot buy an allodial title with notes. So allodial title will disappear if you try to buy it with a note, because you cannot pay a debt with a note. You have to have capital. You have to have money of present value. And we explain that. Stanek versus White is the case you want to look up. But I don't want to get too far off track, as the point is, you can't use fake money, or what they often call is fiat money, money that has no present value. It may have a numerical value, but it has no present value. You can't have that fiat money and have a substantive capitalistic system. As soon as you get rid of capital, real money, you now have something you could call pseudo-capitalism. It's not real capitalism. And soon, because you're using fake money, after a generation or two, you will have a false economy. You'll be buying land you don't actually own. You just own some sort of entitlement to the land, but it's subject to somebody else. And of course, like I was saying, is the king's deer wasn't because the king now owns all the deer. He owns all the hunters of deer. The people are now subject. And that took a number of years, and there are actually court cases that deal with these things. Usually it didn't. Some policy officer beat up the poacher. And there's still guys today poaching animals and saying that they're a free man on the land and all these things, but they're really just renegades. In the Old Testament, they would refer to them as ravens. If you understand in nature what a raven does and how a raven operates, that's what a lot of these people, they're not really members of the king's system. They're just kind of hiding in the cracks. Even some science fiction books talk about that. These people who won't be a part of the system, but they don't have any other system. They're just like lone ravens. Actually, ravens have more of a system than them. But again, I'm giving you a narrative to try to get into understanding when you can see a false economy. And we're going to bring it back to why Iran and so many of the Persians did not have the ability to withstand a few people coming in and taking over their government. And there's a reason why. And it began long before the Ayatollah. It began long before the last Shah took over. There was a Shah before the last Shah, and there were some people in the interim. But the original Shah, or I should say original, back in the early 1900s, he had no system of social welfare for the people. 99% of the social welfare for the people was handled by churches and private charities, and local community members would help each other out. There was no government social welfare, social security, any of these things where the king would take money from one group of people and give it to another group of people. There really was no such thing when William the Conqueror came ashore in Great Britain. William the Conqueror tried to implement one. And of course, that's where the book, The Free Church Report, starts. Which is kind of interesting because it was this week that they have a new Bishop of Canterbury. I don't know if, and I'm going to give it away, I don't know if she calls herself the Bishop of Canterbury. I really haven't done much research. I've seen her. I heard her speech accepting her crowning as the bishop, etc. But she is a total DEI, liberal, socialist. You know, we shouldn't be surprised. We've had popes like this, except for it is a woman. And she is now the archbishop. So if there's going to be another king, she'll be the one who crowns him. Crowned by a woman. And of course, Jesus came to set the captive free, but along comes some church. We won't go into all the history of it, just to kind of bring you up to speed on that. If you have questions, you can ask about those questions in the latter part of this program. But there came a church that started crowning men over other men. Well, you know, whoever's doing that is absolutely diametrically opposed to the purposes of Christ. Because Christ came to set the captive free, not to make other men crowns over the captives, over the subjects. That is absolutely the antithesis of the gospel. But people do it, and so you may have to obey the king. And of course, that had gone on before Jesus arrived. For this, the reason the Judea fell prey to Rome, and actually almost fell prey to Parthia, which is basically the roots of Persia. Most people don't know it, but a Parthian king came to Judea to put a king on the throne in Judea after Herod. After Hyrcanus, to replace Hyrcanus. And he came all the way there to put somebody else on the throne. He did put them on the throne. I think I have that covered in our article on Parthia. And they did it partly because in the bloodline of Christ are some of the same people that are in the bloodline of the Parthian kings and Parthian high priests. And we've covered that in our study of John the Baptist. But anyway, they actually came over and put somebody in the throne. Herod, who we call Herod the Great, was part of removing that guy so that he was not on the throne. But for a brief moment, because Rome's major competition in the world at the time that Rome rose to power was Parthia. And there's a whole history of that most people are completely unaware of. But Romans were a little bit afraid of Parthia because the Parthians were very powerful, very well organized. But they made the same mistake back then. The Magi probably came from Parthia. It is very likely that they came from Parthia. And you know, that's why you see the Magi on camels, not necessarily mentioned in the Bible, but traditionally you see the Magi coming on camels. Well, there aren't camels for the most part. You'd see them once in a while coming through with traders in Judea, but camels didn't live in that area, especially at that time. But if the Magi was from Parthia, they very well might have come with camels. But anyway, side story, just tidbits of history, putting it together, looking at the robes of John the Baptist leads you to believe that, hey, that's what the priests in Parthia wore. And of course, somewhere John the Baptist was raised up. He had to be in hiding. What greater place to go than Parthia? Because Romans ain't going to bother you there. Herod isn't going to send anybody to get you there. They're not going to be welcome. But he came back. And he came back wearing camel hair, camel's hair skin or whatever, camel hair coat with certain kinds of leather belts. That all tells us he's probably been in Parthia. But why did Parthia rise to great heights and then crumble as a kingdom? The same reason that the Ayatollah took over so easily in Iran, in what used to be Persia, what used to be Parthia. They made the same fatal error. And that's part of that false economy, because there's a false economy of money where you create fake money, fiat money, we can call it fiat money, etc. And you cannot operate capitalism with fiat money. You have to have real substance, and you have to have a right to own that substance. You don't have that right now. And you don't have it right now for the same reason the Persians of Iran fell under the authority of the Ayatollah. For the same reason the Persian Empire collapsed and was defeated. Because they keep going back to the same error. And we're going to get to that error so that you can see it. And we've already mentioned it, but you may not have connected the dots yet. So you have a fake economy. You don't really own the land you have. The money you have isn't really substance. Even if you were to go and buy gold and silver, if you're a subject, they can still come and take it away from you because you don't actually own it. You only own a legal title to it. That is only gives you the appearance of owning it. And that's actually in the definition. I didn't make that up. And so you think you're free, but you're not, because you're enmeshed in a false economy of substance. You don't really own the substance. You don't really own the land. You don't really own your children. Now, they don't want you to know that yet, but you don't. Because if you all find out that you actually have all become subjects, you've all become slaves, you're all gone into the cauldron, you've all got one purse, you actually already own nothing. And a lot of you feel the sting of that, and you don't feel happy yet. But those of you, when he says you'll own nothing and you'll be happy, the ones that aren't happy with owning nothing, they will have done away with. And everybody else is living in utopian 15-minute cities or whatever they have in store for you. You'll be living under a global government. And, you know, just like the Nine Rings of Tolkien, You know, they have these, they have the Chinese over here and the Russians over here and the European Union over here and the United States over here. And they all have a little bit of power, some more than others. But eventually the goal is one ring rules them all. So in that fictitious narrative is being foretold the future hopes of, we could put the word on it right now, globalism. We'll actually jump to the word that I'm going to use at the end of this. And I've used it before. Globalism is just a way of saying Babylon. So you're all going to be in Babylon. Nimrod's going to be at the top. The Antichrist is going to be at the top. And you're all in this. And you have no hope in yourself. You cannot save yourself. It is too great an enemy, but you can be saved, and it will take divine intervention. Just like when you come out of Egypt, and you come to the Red Sea, with the sea at your back. And no place to go, and all the armies of the Pharaoh coming down on, all the armies of globalism coming down on. Now, there's a few other pieces of the puzzle that have to fit into place yet, but eventually it's going to come about that that's where everybody's going to be at. Now, a lot of people are facing that right now in one degree or another because the different kings that are going around oppressing these people or oppressing those people. I mean, Iran killed thousands and thousands of their own people, of their own subjects. They actually went into the hospitals and put bullet holes in their heads when they were already wounded. I mean, we're not talking about a few incidences on the streets of Minnesota where some people did some really stupid things and ended up in violent situations that where they were struggling against the government that they actually eat at the table of, and they got shot. It's a terrible tragedy that they got shot, but they were doing lots of stupid things. I just saw a video just recently of a cop making a regular stop, and that person seemed to be cooperative, and then they start saying that they wanted to get these other people out of here, and he says, what are you talking about? What other people? Well, there were a bunch of people in the back seat that the cop didn't see. And all of a sudden they opened up fire on the cop. I mean, it was a lot of shooting and other cops shooting and people crying out, they're in the back seat. And then they started shooting in the back seat and all this stuff. He just was making a regular traffic stop. He didn't know he was going to be in a shootout. And the driver seemed to be cooperative, but there were people hidden in the vehicle. He didn't know that. So it's a very dangerous position to be wearing a badge and a gun on the street. I know I've done that too. I still have relatives doing that on a day-to-day basis. And it's very dangerous, very stressful. And all the citizens should be very sympathetic and cooperative and work out your differences in the court. And one of the people I just recently saw, a woman pulled over because her license, or the sticker on her license plates was expired. The sticker was out of date. And she didn't want to give a driver's license, and she did, why are you stopping me? I'm just traveling. I'm not doing anything commercial, etc. I've heard all this before, and these people are ignorant. And there's people out there telling them narratives that just ain't so. If you have a sticker on your license plates, that at your license plates is and registered to you. So it says you're the owner. You're only the owner of the legal title. A legal title is regulated because a legal title is in commerce. The car is in commerce. And you can take off the plate. It's still in commerce unless you take off all the VIN numbers because they've got that registered. and they've got them all over the car. So you can't, it's very difficult to get them all. I actually known of a cop who wanted to give the people a ticket, and they'd taken off the plates, put other on, and he was just looking for the VIN number. And they had taken off one of the VIN numbers. But he knew where the others were hidden, and eventually he found the VIN number and arrested them. Because they were commercially driving a vehicle they only had legal title to. And they don't understand the law because they don't go into the detail. They hear a narrative they like, and they think they stop. They stop looking for the whole truth. And they get themselves in a lot of trouble. And I try to warn people not to do that, et cetera, et cetera. And they just won't listen. And we're going to get into some of those narratives that people, where they get a partial narrative and they want to stick with that. But if you only have a partial truth, you have a false view. And economically, you will be at a disadvantage because you'll think you have an allodial right, or you'll think you're in the right, and you won't be. So it's very important to get into the details and find out what is really going on. So we've gone past 1066, and like I said, the Free Church Report, we have a picture of Lady Godiva on the cover of that. You can find that at hisholychurch.org. You can find it at Preparing You, but the actual PDF will be at hisholychurch.org, and you can read it for free. You can download it and read it for free. I'm not selling you books. I'm giving you information for free. It's not for free because it's going to cost you your delusions. And your delusions come about because you accept some of the truth, but not the whole truth. You want the whole truth because part of the truth is going to get you into trouble. Going to get you into a lot of trouble. And you might do something really stupid like a lot of those people who came out of Egypt that didn't follow Moses. And they turned north and went along the usual route, which was they knew where it went. And we never heard of them again. I don't know how they offended. You want to be following Moses, but really you want to be following Christ. So you got to know the wholeness of the gospel and be following that. And that's where Iran got into trouble. They didn't follow the wholeness of the gospel. They didn't even follow the original religion in Parthia. If you go way back, it's probably the oldest religion we know of in the world, which was Zoroastrian. And that religion was out of Parthia, and it had some basic ideas and concepts and philosophies. But I'll save that for another show. But it breaks down. It's very difficult to know exactly, but I quote from the Asuras, which is part of the Zoroastrian stuff, in the beginning of the book, Thy Kingdom Comes, because what I'm quoting is the family laws. And most of Zoroastrian religion consisted of the family. And of course, that's what I just said earlier, is in the beginning, there was the institution of the family, man and wife. And Zoroast knew that. So he didn't have to give you all kinds of rules about that. But eventually they wrote the Asuras, the family laws, and that all comes down from the basic teachings of Zoroastria. Other things came down, but like I said, it wasn't written. It's one of the oldest, so it's had more time to be distorted than all the other religions. And so that distortion, one of the key things in that distortion is why Parthia fell, why the Iranian people, Persians, were so easily defeated by these very few people that came in and took over their government, and with the help of other people. They had to be financed by somebody. And it's why, if you go look at, you know, that you see their Ayatollah, their supreme leader, and of course he died, and so they have one of his sons took over supposedly afterwards, but he also got injured in an explosion. So he's not even in the country. He's receiving medical help somewhere else. I can't remember where for sure, but probably in hiding somewhere. But the reality is, we know who he is. We know he owns hundreds of millions of dollars in property in London. That's just a matter of a record. You can look that up. Why? Because it was London banking that financed them going in and taking over Iran to begin with. It wasn't just London. Germany was in on it. France was in on it. And the son who got injured, he has multi-millions of dollars in some in the Cayman Islands. Most of it's probably in St. Kitts. Again, British banking. It could be all the way over in this Venezuelan banking empire. The point is, there's a lot going on behind the scenes that didn't have anything to do with Islam. It has to do with other people. And you could find the same thing. I mean, like, where does Zelensky bank? We know he has a $1 million mansion outside of his own country that he has obtained while the war is going on. That's going to be his refuge when the war is finally ended. But England doesn't want the war to end there. And they've openly, we've got video of them stopping it, stopping the signing of the peace treaty twice. There's probably been several times. Every time they make another deal. And we can go into that. But it's you have false wars going, proxy wars going on. People are really dying. But nobody's really defending Ukrainian people. They're suffering. Millions of them have already fled the country. Thousands and thousands died and are not going to ever have children. Their property, they've been displaced from their properties. Now we're coming on to the growing season. Are they even going to be able to plant? They may be moving everybody towards famine. If they don't settle this soon and start planting, that's what you're going to have. And we know famine in that area has killed more people than bombs. So you're not even seeing the beginning of it if all that's going on. Because we're believing false narratives that are coming at us hook, line, and sinker from the media. Bits and pieces of the truth come out, but you have to understand what globalism is, what Babylon is, what the difference in the spirit of Babylon and the spirit of Christ. Because I can guarantee you, the new bishop of Canterbury doesn't know. But neither does the Pope. Neither do most British people. They don't understand. They don't really know what's going on because they have a false narrative, and part of that comes from a false economy. When I talk about this idea of a false economy, one of the things that we have this idea of victim psychology, that we're victims. And of course, Iranians think they're victims of Islam. But they're actually victim, and I'm using them as an example. This same narrative can go on in the United States and go on in Australia. We've already done programs about Australia, how before America even did it, Americans went to Australia and helped set up their social welfare system. You know, where you get a social security number, what we call a social security number. You get one, and that was being set up in Australia before it was set up in the United States. It was also about the same period of time it was being set up in Iran, that they were setting this up, like I said, originally in Iran under the first Shah, who was mostly, like I say, building railroads and harbors and things like that, that would be useful in building the infrastructure of an economy, a real economy. And of course, we did that in the United States. We set up a competition that if you build it, well, we weren't financing the building of it. They had to finance the building of it. But if you built all the track you built on, you get to create the spur lines off of it. The farther you went across the U.S., the more spur lines you were going to be able to create and the more business you would have brought in. So we were very clever, but The Shah was actually financing, probably had other financiers. This is way back in the turn of the 1900s. But he needed that infrastructure in order to create a booming economy that was going to help the people. But then somebody got the idea, well, let's help the people by giving them social welfare. Well, it has been known for centuries and centuries, when the state takes over social welfare, liberty is destroyed. The greatest destroyers of liberty are the givers of gifts, gratuities, and benefits. And they went from a church economy of the poor, because their welfare system is the economy of the poor, which is a true, there's a double advantage when you're taking care of the poor through charity. One is the charity that is going to the poor is governed by the sweat of the person who gives charity. Somebody was reading to me today the statistics for who gives the most charity. If you make over $120,000 a year in the United States, you will give less money to charity per the amount of money that you earn than if you make $50,000 a year. If you're a family making $50,000 a year, you will give a larger percentage of your income to charity, statistically speaking. So the middle class, and even 50,000 is almost below middle class, is more charitable. As a matter of fact, this is an older statistics, but people who work at Walmart on average give more money to charity based on their income, a larger percentage of money to charity, a percentage of their income to charity than the Waltons, who own Walmart and are multi-millionaires, probably billionaires. They give less money per capita per dollar they earn to charity than their employees. And that is classically because America is not a Christian nation anymore. And when you set up a system of social welfare through the state, you're going to get that. Which is why people like Jeff Bezos wants guaranteed wages, you know, a minimum wage, a high minimum wage. He wants that because it will put his competition out of business. He will get away with it because one of the first things their HR does for their employees, if an employee is in a family of five and they're working for them, they'll get them on social benefits. If there's any social benefits available to them, their HR department is instructed to help them get those social welfare. So he doesn't mind going up to $20 an hour because he's going to subsidize his employees with government money. And there's other tax breaks that he's looking for too, but he's actually using the minimum wage laws to defeat his competition because he's got the market cornered, you know, on Amazon. So, and this forces all the people selling to depend upon Amazon rather than just do it on their own, you know, and ship and sell their own stuff. I knew a monastery that sold ink for printers. And they had set up the whole thing and helped support their monastery. But they eventually were driven out of that business because the only way they were going to sell is by going in with Amazon. And then Amazon would take the additional profit margin and it wouldn't be worth it. Also, there were a number of hurdles to do for the monastery because they had... They were a group of monks under a vow of poverty. But that's another whole story. The fact is there are elements in the legal system, in the system in Iran, in the system in Great Britain, in the system even in Venezuela, and the system in Mexico and Colombia, etc., that are moving the population towards globalism and Babylon. They're very close to it now, all across the world, but they're still trying to move. And some people are trying to fight globalism without understanding the underlying cause or the major motivating factor in this psychology of humanity that draws all the people towards Babylon. Okay, so besides the exchanges with lots of different people, some by phone, some that were actually here, and the reality is that I'm using Iran as an example, but all the stuff that's going on is going on because of this constant war that we've had since the days of Nimrod. And of course, the caliphate is the idea of a caliphate. It's a central ruler and everybody is subject to the caliphate. And the caliphate, he doesn't go around and rule every little thing, but he is the ultimate authority. And then everybody, he has all his governors, etc., under him, and they keep all the people in order. But it isn't setting the people free. It's bringing them under. It's idolatry, the essence of idolatry. Because, again, idolatry is covetous practices. So they're trying to bring you under a globalist government, a Babylonic government, where somebody's in charge and everybody is in a cauldron, a civil cauldron, and you have become merchandise. You have become human resources. You may be given the imagery of owning your own property and owning your own business, etc., but they have to bring you into subjection so that you do not have access to your right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Somebody else can terminate you, can terminate your ownership, can take your sons and daughters, like many of the caliphates demanded. Different provinces send them 300 slaves every year. That was a common thing. And some had to send 200 slaves, some 300 slaves. And it's just a matter of record. And they believed in slavery. And they believed in subjugating people. And the people who were not out and out slaves, they were still in a snare and a trap. The Bible writes about that snare and a trap. How do you get in this snare and a trap? You eat at the table of rulers because they serve you deceitful meats. First thing that happens when you are eating the benefits, the bread of rulers, is your eyes are darkened and scales are on your eyes. These are different quotes I'm making reference to. And they get more power and you degenerate as a person. You have less vision, less perception. And again, like we were studying Leviticus, the same word for breast. There are several words for breast. Actually, the other word for breast that actually may refer to a woman's breast, it can refer to animal's breasts, the mammary source of milk for the new generation, etc. The same word can also mean demon, or chaos, or destruction, or ruin. Same word. But the breast that you see with the priests, where they hold it as a wave offering, that's a different word entirely. And you could say, well, that word means meat. You know, like the breast of a chicken. Or the breast of a lamb. Or the breast of an oxen. And they say this is a wave offering. The same exact word is also the word for prophesy or illuminated decision making. And so what is actually going on? Does he get the actual chunk of meat and wave it over his head and this makes God happy? Or does he return it to the people in the form of its charity? It's the opportunity of him exercising charity according to the enlightenment in his own heart and mind to the people. It's not his meat. It is not his, part of the sacrifice that he's giving back to the people. It's a portion that has come up to him through heave offerings, and he's passing it down to the people. He could do it all kinds of ways. He could build an aqueduct with it to bring water into Jerusalem with a wave offering. Of course, at the time that they built an aqueduct to go into Jerusalem to bring fresh water into the rising population, he didn't do that. He just went out on the balcony before the people and waved barley grain in the air. And everybody said their prayers. And then he went back into his lavish quarters. At that time, historically, we know that the high priests of Judea in Jerusalem had more opulent quarters than the king himself, than Pontius Pilate himself. More money went into building their abode in the capital of Jerusalem than went into building the housing for Pontius Pilate and his wife, and more than Herod the Great. Now, admittedly, Herod had other quarters like Masada, but the reality is the opulence of the two are noticeably different according to archaeologists. Well, the high priest, because they already forgot what the wave offering was really for, they said, that's the portion for the high priest. So he would be getting all this extra and living like a king. He could have had a golden scepter on his head. He could have had a golden staff like the bishop in Great Britain. But he was supposed to be like Christ, who would go out and sleep in an orchard, an olive orchard. And everything he had, though he was rich, he was making himself poor. But instead, we had the high priests in Judea, who should have been poor, making themselves rich. So when they wanted to build an aqueduct, Pontius Pilate took money from their Social Security fund. What Social Security fund is that? The Corban of the Pharisees and Herod and the Sadducees that they had set up, a social welfare system that would take and take and take and take, that would weaken the poor, degenerate the people, and give rise to tyrants like Herod. So Herod implemented that. They did the same thing in Iran. They did the same thing in the United States. They did the same thing in Australia. And the people were blind to it. Well, if you tried to do that in 1840 in the United States, people would have come out and say that's immoral. They would have told their politicians that's immoral. I won't vote for you because you want to create welfare through the state. That's what they said. We have the article. Go look up Davy Crockett at Preparing You. That the citizens said that that's immoral, that we should not do that. We should not create welfare through the state. We have to take care of it. Lady Godiva said the same thing in 1090 after William the Conqueror already came into England because he tried to implement social welfare through the state. She said, no, we have to do it ourselves. Under FDR, there were some people that said, no, we can't do this. But other churches agreed to do it. Like I told you, a meeting with Eleanor Roosevelt in New York. They agreed. They made some sort of an agreement. They didn't write it down where I know of it yet. Although the son of FDR, not the son, excuse me, the son-in-law of FDR says that, yeah, there was an agreement. And they sold you down. They sold you into human resources. Of course, you were buying it. You were willing to covet your neighbor's goods through men who exercise authority despite the revelation by Jesus Christ and the instructions of Jesus Christ not to do so. You thought it was okay. Well, they thought it was okay in Iran when they set up that social welfare system. They thought it was okay in Australia when they set it up. Of course, now they did it a little bit different in each place. Now, in Iran, well, let's go to Australia because they did it first. Australia, they were just going to help the churches. They were actually going to send money to the churches from the government to help them out with taking care of the needy of society. And they took the money. Of course, that isn't the first time it happened. It happened under Constantine. He called all the 1,200 known bishops of Christianity. There were probably more than 1,200, but they at least invited 1,200 known bishops of Christianity. They invite them, the emperor invite them, which means show up. But 300 showed up, which isn't a quorum. It's not even half, not even a quarter, really, who showed up. And we call that, you know, Council of Milan, whatever. Same thing, Council of Trent, only 150 showed up. And that was the beginning of the Catholic Church. And what did he do? He gave him millions and millions of dollars from assets he had confiscated from people he murdered. And they took it. Lady Godiva wouldn't take it. Lady Godiva didn't want her Norman husband, her original husband had died. She was the largest property owner at that time in England. And she was the only property owner who was a woman who was registered in the Doomsday Book. And chances are she was registered in the Doomsday Book because her husband, I haven't researched this, so I don't really know, but I would suspect that her husband died maybe at the Battle of Hastings or somewhere along that line that her husband may. That would be worth looking up. I haven't looked that up. I know what her sons were doing. I didn't, but her husband died and she married a Norman. But she knew that, no, the church cannot take money from taxation from the state to take care of the needy of society. She knew enough about Christianity to know that that would be covetous practice. You can explain this over and over again to modern Christians and they don't get it. They don't see that it's a covetous practice, you know, and it's just obvious that it is. But when you accept that idea, you know, just like Polybius says, it will start to degenerate. The people will start weakening the people and start strengthening governments. So you will find Islamists in favor of socialism. They'll all get on socialist programs. And they will take the tax money and they will set it up even in their own countries. And you can have a benevolent guy doing it. You know, like the, is it UAE? United Arab Republic. But anyway, they're fairly benevolent on the surface. I could play you some videos that will show you how they're looking at Iran is just brutal to their people. They're not as brutal to theirs, but women still don't have the same rights as they would in America. Of course, we had the discussion today, should we have given women the right to vote in the United States? Well, I tell you what, if we look back at the time they gave women the right to vote in the United States, did they give women the right to vote whether or not women get the right to vote? Because we had, some people had the, some women had the right to vote. I think it was in Utah. But when they turned out, should all the women in the United States get a right to vote? Their determination was like 4% voted yes. The rest said no. Very few people, very few women who even had the right to vote. But the reality is that there's, when you have the right to vote, you have the right to be drafted. So that's an interesting point of view. But the reality is back to false economy. One of the tools of globalism of Babylon is to alter the money so it isn't of value. Alter title to property. So it is not complete, it's not whole, it's not allodial, it's not a freehold title. so that you only own land by government suffrage. You only own your animals by government permission as well. That's what was going on in Egypt. You had sheep in Egypt. You had land in Egypt, but you didn't actually own it. The Pharaoh owned it, but the Pharaoh also owned you. So these are the two governments in the world. The one that wants to lead you towards liberty under God. But in order to do that, in order to get your right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness back, you have to take back your responsibilities to protect not only your life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness, but your neighbor's right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. That means that if he falls on hard times, you have to have a charitable institution to take care of his needs. And that will make your community stronger. It will create the social bonds of a free society that are necessary to withstand the attempts to become a tyrant in your nation. If the Iranians had stuck to taking care of their needy through faith, hope, and charity, like they had, they would have been strong enough to resist the Ayatollah when he first started gaining a hold. But I fear for them because already they're looking at bringing back the Shah. Although Shah says he doesn't want to rule. He just wants to be interim so that they get another government. If they pick the idea of having a government take care of their social welfare again, if they haven't learned the lesson of that, which I have very little evidence that they have, they will set the world up for a greater tyranny than you can imagine. Their world. And every country that does that sets their country up for tyranny and destruction because you're going to weaken the people. That's the false economy, is to think that the government has a right to take away from any class of citizen, whether it's Julius Caesar taking away from the Gauls or, you know, the Shah taking away from the rich and or the oil companies or whatever it is. If you're going to take it away from one class to feed another class, you're giving somebody the power to do that. And men who seek power will seek that office and they will seek more and more power. And the secondary thing that I started to mention before, that when you do charity through the people, through free will offerings, your people will become weaker because it makes you stronger to give, not just for it, and it strengthens your character to give not just to those who can help you, but give to those who cannot help you. We just covered that in our Leviticus 8 dialogue. And so that's the thing, is that you could go back to gold and silver money. You could go back to a democratically elected government in Iran or in Australia or whatever. It won't work in Australia. They're trying to fix, you know, with the voter ID in the United States. We know they've been cheating. But even if you get rid of the cheaters, democracies always fail because the people will decide. If you decide that it's okay to take away from one class of citizens to provide for another by force, you have a false economy that will lead to bondage. It will lead to weakness. It will lead to tyranny. It always has. It always will. And if you knew history, you'd know that. But you don't know history. You have a narrative of history. You don't know all the details. And it is absolutely dangerous to accept one single narrative and think, I have found the problem. It's these guys over here in the corner. Or it's these guys. Because evil wants you to do that. The evil has wars through proxy. They have economies through proxy. You don't get real money. You get fake money. You don't get a real title. You get fake title. It was amazing to me when Iraq was taking over Kuwait, and we were getting these stories, the media, we couldn't trust them back then either, of the Kuwaiti soldiers coming in and stealing all the incubators in the hospital and leaving babies laying on the floor dying. Never happened. It's totally made up by a daughter of one of the embassy people, and she was paid to do it. I mean, she was encouraged to do it by people who wanted to create this false narrative. But you know what they actually did? They changed the license plates of all the Kuwaiti vehicles. See, Kuwait had a system of license where you would get a sticker, and next year you have to buy, oh, yeah, I don't know if it was 1 year or 2 years or whatever, but eventually that sticker would expire and you'd have to buy another sticker from the state. People say, well, it's to get revenue. No, it's to secure the fact that you don't actually own the vehicle. Because if you have to buy, if you don't buy that new sticker here in the United States, they'll take the whole car away from you. $250,000, $300,000 Maserati or Mercedes or whatever it is, they'll take the whole car away from you. They'll sell it at auction and they'll keep all the money because you don't own it. You don't own it. They can terminate your parental rights because you just have those children on lease. If those children are registered, those children belong to the state. The car's registered, the children are registered, your land is registered. You're living in a false economy now, trying to create these guys saying, well, we want a capitalist to say free market society. We already went over that. You can't have a free market society when you're competing with a communist nation. And the truth is, all 10 planks of the Communist Manifesto are law in the United States now. It's just not quite as extreme, but it can turn extreme rapidly. Probably won't happen under the existing president today, but he's not going to be in there forever. The structure, the falseness of the economy, the falseness of your liberty already exists, and it exists because you are willing to take away the liberty of your neighbor about having a free school. You want a free school? Public school. We want to have a public school. We want the government to pay for our public school. How does the government do that? It either borrows money from the future of your children, or it forces your neighbor to pay property tax. And of course, since a lot of the school is now funded by the federal government, then your Congress is meeting every couple of months and refunding it. And they're great, beautiful bills, but it's all covetous practices. It's false Christianity, false economy, false society, and you will not have the social bonds to withstand. But worse than that, and ultimately, this is where I'll leave you with, if you're going the opposite way that Christ said to go, opposite of the way of a daily ministration funded entirely by faith, hope, and charity, you've been doing that for 100 years almost now, started at least in the 1930s. I mean, it started before that, but it really got going in 30, 33, June 5th, 1933. But it was already going. They'd already started in Australia long before. They started it in Iran about the same time. They do it in Israel. There's a puppet. Israel thinks they're making up their mind. And of course, they have an agenda. And the people that really made them the puppet gave them that country right in the middle of all the Muslim countries that they also could have conquered. I mean, they conquered the Caliphate and the Ottoman Empire. And they could have divvied up everything then, but they did it in a way that there was a limit to what they could do. I mean, their cannon boats and their finances could have done lots of things, but they want these factions fighting at each other. And usually, if you get two or three Arabs in a room, they'll be fighting, the Sunnis fighting the Shiites or whatever. They have a religion that doesn't bring them too much agreement unless you have an iron fist police force. And in some limited economies that have lots of oil revenue, almost everybody in who's a citizen in Saudi Arabia and in these United Arab Emirates, that's it, that's the word I was looking for, they all get a check from their government. And so they keep the people appeased because they have all this oil flowing all the time and the revenue flowing in, although they get into trouble from time to time. Nobody's bucking their system. If you get a big, huge country like Iraq with hundreds of different factions and lots of different, I think there's 14 different languages. There's at least three different languages spoken in Iran, but the Persians are a main part of that. But if they don't learn the lessons of Christ, which are the lessons of Moses, which we're now seeing as we go through Leviticus and Exodus, they will not be free. So what will happen is isolated groups of people will start to repent and start to gather as Christ commanded and start taking care of social welfare through charity and love alone. And then divine inspiration will be their salvation. Inspiration and actual physical intervention eventually. But you don't do it to be saved. You have to come in the spirit of Christ to lay down your life for others. In other words, you come together to serve that others might be saved. And that right now, billions of people are under a strong delusion. Jews are under a strong delusion. Islamists are under a strong delusion. Christians are under a strong delusion. And when I say Christian, that's a huge. Christianity probably has more different sects and groups and ideologies than any other religion, partially because of its size. I don't know, there's an awful lot in Buddhists, but you don't see it so distinctly because they don't have as, but you know, your evangelicals are running off this way and other guys are running off that way. Your Catholics are doing this. Obviously, we just saw the some of you may have seen it, the bishop, the new bishop in Great Britain. The Church of England is toast, but England's toast. But anyway, England's having a hard time. And I know a lot of people in England. I know people who grew up in the United Arab Emirates. And he's actually from Pakistan, I think, originally. At least his parents are. But he lives in England now. And he actually may be coming out for a visit here shortly. But so I know a lot of these people. I know what they're going through. But this basic of the gospel is absolutely essential that you not only comprehend it, you start applying it in every narrative. That we want all Israelis to be saved. We have no power over doing that. I want all Iranians to be saved. I want all Islamists, or what do you call it, Muslims. I want all Muslims to be saved. But they have to realize what Christ really was saying. They have to realize it deep down spiritually in their heart. Otherwise, all their economies, all their governments will be false. They will all be under a strong delusion, and they will be on the wrong side of whatever is coming. But if they repent, I don't care about all the verbiage and the words. The principle is what we have to seek in everything. And that's the whole reason I've dedicated my life to sharing all this information to you. So for one last time, I'm looking to see if anybody has grabbed a mic. I was going to get a little bit into this idea of victim psychology, and I can briefly touch on that. We've seen this in the DEI kind of stuff that people they want to think, they get a feeling of almost superiority because they have this victimhood. They want to think of themselves as victims. And this was spread along with the DEI philosophy or ideology. And psychological effects and responses experienced by actual victims of trauma, crime, abuse, or other harms, often studied in what they call victimology or trauma psychology. But there's also this victim mentality, also called victim complex or victimhood mindset or tendency to interpersonal victimhood. It's a pattern, way of thinking where someone perceives themselves as perpetually powerless, wronged, subject of bigotry or racism, even in situations where they have agency or when the harm is not ongoing. They have this victim mentality. Those two things are different. But one of the things in this, see, this victim mentality, if you are truly believing in Christ, truly believing in God, what is one of the things they always tell you? That you have to, Jesus did this when he prayed. He knew that his prayer was already answered. He knew in his heart that God was hearing, and he was gracious and grateful already. The victim is not grateful. The person who's suffering from victim mentality is not grateful. He actually wallows in his victimhood. Now, we've seen this. You know, and there's emotional reactions because of that, like fear, anxiety, anger, irritability, sadness, grief, shame, guilt, emotional numbness. There's also cognitive changes where you have a negative belief about yourself, that you're damaged, and that bad things will keep happening because you're damaged, because you're a victim. You can also have a lot of cortisol in your system because you become hypervigilant, etc. All these things, if you study the psychology of it, all these things show up. And of course, you know, there is a real, what they call post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, that brings about depression and anxiety and all this stuff. But see, if somebody victimizes you, and you instantaneously forgive them, and you bless God for your trials and tribulations, you don't think of yourself as a victim. You think of everything as an opportunity. And you accept the pain. You know, I tell you about healing. Go to the pain. Well, it's the same thing as an emotional pain. And you can do this more readily if you love everybody. If you become a candle of love shining out in every direction all the time, and anytime somebody tries to upset you from that, make you a victim, hit you, call you names, you instantly forgive. You leave judgment to God. Then you won't fall into this victim mentality that will actually destroy you and age you and make you weaker and weaker and weaker. But the reason I bring that up in this particular case, because it's part of the false economy of emotions, is that when you become empathetic for the underdog, which is very common for us to do. You know, I saw two people fighting, and there was a big guy that got in between the two. And you can see that when the big guy got in between the two, the little guy got more aggressive and the big guy had to keep pushing him back because the little guy felt like, I got the big guy to protect me. I can try to get a kick in or a hit in or something like that. But he just kept pushing them apart. And that's one way to deal with it. Sometimes you can just let them go at it and see how quickly it quits. And try to keep somebody from murdering the other one. But they have to learn to discipline themselves, not to lose their temper, not to become the victim, not to make victims of other people. And of course, I've had that problem growing up. We all have the little fights that we have as we grow up. We learn to not be such hotheads and not to, you know, hopefully what you learn when you're 8 will protect you from having to go to anger management when you're older. But really what I wanted to bring up, when you support the underdog because he's the underdog, what you're doing is not sympathizing with his position, you're empathizing with his position. You're feeling his victimhood. And it can actually poison your own mind. Because your empathy for his victimhood, some people want to be victims. They know they're not going to win. They want to be victims. They're in love with victimhood. They become addicted to victimhood. And even though they know they don't have a chance on God's green earth to succeed, they will play the victim. You know, I've seen it plenty of times with traffic stops where people think that, you know, well, you're just stopping me because I'm black. And that very seldom happens anymore. I'm not going to say it doesn't happen. I'm sure it does happen. But people want to think that they're victims, and they make really bad choices when they're under this emotional trauma state. But you can make bad choices and be swept away by their victimhood when you empathize with people that are addicted to being a victim. And it can distort your view of things. I'm just saying it. You can still have the views you want to have. But see, you don't have any of those things if you love everybody. One of the things about love, it's not bias. You can love the sinner and hate the deed. We identify the sinner with the deed. We're going in the wrong direction. The deed is separate than the sinner. The sinner is a soul created by God. Now, what is love for that sinner? It isn't license. It isn't making excuses for him to keep on sinning. You have to go up and say, you know, Iran, you're in this problem because of the fact that you would not see that social welfare through the state is against the teachings of Zoroaster, against the teachings of Abraham, against the teachings of Moses, against the teachings of Jesus Christ, because some Iranians were all of the above. You cannot want benefits through the state. And because you turn a blind eye to that, you became a victim. Now you want to feel like they're the bad guys and you're the victim. Well, they may be bad guys and they may have to deal with all the bad and the wickedness they do, but you have to be ready to forgive them. And forgiving them is simply turning judgment over to God and dealing with your own problem, your covetous nature that made you so weak that a few Muslims and clerics could come in and take over your whole nation. Now, admittedly, it was a lot more than just a few Muslims and clerics and radical extremists. They had access to your youth because that's where they went. They went to the colleges and got them to back their socialist ideology, at least till 1988. And then they killed a lot of them, or they had to flee the country. And then things got really brutal after that. But why were your children going to public education to begin with? Why weren't you creating your own schools by charity? You see, once you step over that line, you're headed for, you know, destruction. And you're driving in the dark. And because you can't see anymore. Once you step over that line, you can't see anymore. Your eyes are dimmed. You know, and for some reason, I just keep thinking of my own father was driving through Italy during World War II, and he crossed a bridge with his driver was driving. He was carrying information to the front lines because he was in the commandos. And they went over a bridge, and on the way back, they were driving without their headlights on because their target, they're in enemy territory. Every place was enemy territory in Italy at that time. And they were driving, but the bridge wasn't there anymore. It was there when they left, but it wasn't there when they came back. And they went over and the driver was killed and my dad was eventually captured. But you're driving in the dark. If you set up a system contrary to Christ, contrary to faith, hope, and charity, that is dependent upon police and policies and kings and prime ministers to force the contributions of your neighbor so that you can have free education, free health care, free welfare, free medical, whatever it is. If you do that, you will be blind and driving in the dark. So fix that, and God will take care of the rest. So with that, I'll say peace on your house, and may God be with you. God bless. Thanks, everybody, for coming. God bless. Oh, wait. Has somebody got a hand up? Oh, there is a speaker. Oh, Kat.
Hello. Hello.
Okay.
I was trying to get one earlier. I don't know what was going on, but when you're talking about false money and all the things you mentioned, what came to my mind is false hope. You know, false security that we get these benefits and we think it's going to make everything okay, and it really doesn't, and it's false liberty. And I just wonder what your take is on that, why people are so adverse to hearing that it's bad to take money from the government, even though it looks like my son is going to have to. We're just in that position. But what is your take on that?
Well, it almost never comes without strings attached, but you don't feel the string until later. And I can't give people a license to take that money, but I don't have a right to say you can't take that money. But you have to know that, you know, I don't want anybody starving to death today. I want everybody to have it tomorrow. And I know people that have had to depend upon these government programs. We've gone so far down that way. Eventually, and maybe not very long in the future, they will all dry up. They also know that there are strings attached to them. If you're in the system, you got to pay Caesar what is Caesar's. And I had a bunch of notes. They're still on my phone. I'll save them for another time. Where somebody was talking, it was actually Kevin Craig, who I have a great deal of respect for, but he just doesn't seem to get the gospel. He thinks he does. He was talking about Paul's letter to the Romans and the things that he was saying in there. He still doesn't understand Romans 13 because he doesn't understand the gospel and doesn't understand. Paul was writing citizens of Rome who were coming out of the system of Roman welfare. Probably most of them weren't taking the free bread to begin with. They were probably middle class, but they were different than other Christians, most of the other Christians at that time, because the Christians at that time were almost 90% Jews, maybe more. But there were Romans that were following Christ. We know that way back when Christ was preaching in Judea, there was Roman centurion. Well, he wasn't alone. And a lot of them were looking for this other way of faith, hope, and charity. If you don't have it and you have to take the benefit to survive, I'm not the judge of that, but you be the judge of that. And you need to double your efforts to create the alternative. Like I said, people that make $50,000 a year will give more of their total wages to charity than people who make $125,000. The $50,000 will give a higher percentage of their wages to charity than the people who make $125,000 or more. And I'm not sure of the psychology of that, but I find that to be a fascinating statistic. That if you find yourself between a rock and a hard place and you know these strings are going to attach, you have to put in the extra time, the extra effort. You know, it's like, like all these recordings that we did before, and I had edited them for some reason, it crashed. And I noticed that all those things that I had saved somehow got lost. We had upgraded and all this other stuff, and somehow that was lost. So I have to redo it all. And my daily chores haven't diminished. So what is it? What the guy says to the Emperor Palpatine, we will double our efforts. And so if you have to take these benefits today, double your efforts, because tomorrow they may not be there. And so you really have to dedicate towards it. And I really recommend everybody pray about it. I can't give people answers on individual things, but I can tell you there's strings attached. And to be...
Yes, and I'm not looking for that, you know, confirmation or anything. I really don't have a choice. He's an adult and he's going to apply whether I want him to or not.
Right.
But the strings attached are, they are severe. There can be severe penalties if you spend some of that money in a way, or you make a mistake, or you're in a bad way and you do something wrong as the executor, or even as the person spending the money. They can come back and make you pay back all the back pay if you can't prove something. So it's pretty stressful.
Yeah, it's that, you know, like I have one son that went into politics, which was really a surprise why he even did that. And this is his last term. He says he's never going to run again. But he's got another full-time job that he's going to. But and he's learned a lot that he wouldn't have learned otherwise. And I believe there was some reason, and he knows a lot that he would have never known before. But I warned him that, you know, because I couldn't give him any information about that, about what he should do. I know only the Holy Spirit needs to guide you. And if I interfere with that, I'll really be in trouble. But I said, there's two things they're going to want you to do. One is they're going to want you to break the law. That and sure enough, countless times, they've tried to get, but fortunately he's an instruction reader and he knows what the law is. And they also want to get you to be, well, I won't go into the details of it, but you know, they want you to believe in the pomp and position. They want you to depend upon their approval for to make your choices in that office. And so, in other words, they want to distract you from the Holy Spirit guiding you in that office. And sure enough, all those temptations, he saw them over and over again. I think that it's wore on him heavily, but I think he's a better person for it. So, yeah, and so these are the trials that are coming up on your son. Your daughter's had the same situation.
It's the same person.
Oh, you're talking about the same person. I was wondering, because yeah, I know your son had trouble too.
His is better.
Yeah. Okay. So anyway.
Yes.
Yeah, it's you know, I will tell you this. I pray for her regularly. I have great hope for her, but I have no control. She's going to have to face these issues herself. And maybe this will move her into a place where she's going to see it. But one thing we have to believe, that there is a God and he's in control. And we have to be careful to guard ourselves against stepping in to control others. And this is all the wars and rumors of wars we're seeing in the big politics of things and everything. We seem to want to think, well, it's these guys and it's these guys. All these things are coming about because we sit in darkness. And, you know, all the things that happened to Iran, as long as they want to blame other people, they're not accepting the full responsibility of what's come about. And I'm telling you that the Ayatollah, he's responsible for his own sins. The IRCG, I think it is, they call it, for the rapes and the murders and the shooting of people. They're all going to be responsible for that. But as a whole, the trials and tribulations that are upon Iran are the results of the fact that they decided to covet their neighbor's goods through the power of government. But the same can be said for the United States. Yesterday, Biden was in power. Today, or I don't know if Biden was in power, but whoever was standing behind the auto pen was in power. And today Trump is in power. He's duped by some people. He has a plan. I see what he's doing, but I also know how it works. And unless the people repent, nothing Trump is doing will save us. Unless the people of Israel repent of their covetous practices, nothing BB does will save them. It's a delusion. They're just not going to, it's not going to work. The only thing that works, the only way to go is the way of Christ. And the way of Christ is full of love and forgiveness and truth. This is why I always refer to your daughter as your daughter. I get to do that. I understand you're under different pressures. But I'm going to do that till the end.
Yes, I pray for my daughter.
Yeah,
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the fact is that yearning for the welfare of somebody else over our own comfort, that's what gives strength to prayers. Still, it requires a certain amount of patience. The patience has to run out its length because timing is everything and God is in charge of that. And it's a taste of our own faith. We have to persevere. This is why Christ says persevere, strive. Those are words that involve time. And so we should not expect instant answers. So I have a better picture now that I know which of your children that we're talking about. Yeah, that is very dangerous. Just needs more prayer. But if God is in control of things, even if things start turning out bad, God can turn it to good. But the people have to be willing. And sometimes people have to break and under the strain and realize this. Just be very patient. Pray about things. Learn to meditate. And before you say things, before you agree to things, really contemplate about it. You know, when I tell the story of Jacob, where they're calling them into bondage, into Egypt. You got to go to Egypt. And they, for generations, they had avoided that. And he went to the well of Beersheba, which I explained in one of the recordings. To some degree, I explain it. You go to the well of Beersheba, and he receives the message that it will be okay. And actually details of the message supposedly he received that in 400 years, God will send somebody to set your children free. But it won't be your immediate children. It will be your children of your children of your children 400 years later. It's not the same guys. So there was a lot of time involved. Hopefully you don't have 400 years for things to straighten out in your own family. But the reality is that sometimes it needs time. But if you pray about it, God will. And I've told stories of my own life where I've didn't realize I was going to the well of Beersheba, whatever that means. But God said, it's okay. You can do it. And I'll fix it. And he did. And I had no power over it. And that's one of the things you have to realize. You have no power. Your prayers have no power. But the fact that you relinquish the power you thought you had, which is really a delusion, to God, you're saying, I know you can fix this. I can't fix it. That's an important place to be. And it seems like you're getting backed into that corner on a regular basis, which means to me that God still cares. So you just have to let him work his grace in it. So I don't know if that helps you, but.
Very much so. Thank you.
Okay. Okay. And, I will continue to pray for your daughter. And you can even tell her that Gregory's praying for you.
I sure will.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay. God bless. And I'll look real quick for Heather. Okay. So we'll let it go with that. Thanks for the call. Thanks everybody for coming. Sorry about the glitches. We'll see if we can't get them all fixed eventually. God bless. See us on the network at preparingyou.com, hisholychurch.org. You can even go to keysofthekingdom.info for all of our recordings. There's a number of other web pages that you can go to, but join the network. And until then, peace on your house and may God be with you. God bless. For more information, go to hisholychurch.org or preparingyou.com. Join the network. Listen to the audios at most podcast providers under Keys of the Kingdom with Brother Gregory. Thanks, everyone, and God bless. Make sure you follow us at His Holy Church on X.